Sounds good.
All right, thank you so much, Jeffrey Engels, for being on Ride On Radio today.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. Thanks for allowing me to join you.
All right, can you just give us a brief introduction to the, we have not one, but two books to talk about, and they kind of
Yeah.
coincide with each other. So can you just give us a brief introduction about those books?
Absolutely. So the two books that I'm here to talk about today are the first one is Godzilla and Godzilla Raids Again, which were two novellas which were written by Shigeru Kayama. I translated them as a single volume along with my own afterword. And these were very, very closely related to the first two Godzilla movies ever produced. So in 1954 and 1955, written by the same author who wrote the very first draft of the screenplays. So the same guy who basically kind of gave birth to the whole idea of the Godzilla story. And so the second book, that actually that first book was such a success that the people at University of Minnesota Press, who I was working with and who were absolutely wonderful, I hope you're listening, they came back to me and they said that they'd like to do another book. And so the second book I did for them was The Luminous Fairies and Mothra, which was a 1961 novella. That was the basis for the movie Mothra, which was released later that same year in 1961. And this was written by three authors. The three authors' names are Shinichiro Nakamura, Takehiko Fukunaga, and Yoshie Hotta. I realize these are probably not names that most American listeners are used to hearing, but all three of these guys were really, really famous during the mid 20th century in Japan. Really well-known writers. So it was a lot of fun to bring their work into English for the first time.
So I'm kind of curious. I didn't realize this is the first time that these works have been translated into
Yeah.
Can you elaborate more about kind of your work as well as a Japanese literature professor? Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so I teach Japanese literature at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. Yeah, I really love translation. Because translation is not only fun and interesting, it's I think one of the activities that we as scholars can engage in to open up the world of literature a great deal. Like I've done a lot of translation of various novels, but this is kind of a new foray for me. I haven't really worked in the field of science fiction or kind of fantasy novels very much. Typically, what I've done is in the past is poetry, novels, and things like that. But so this is a new venture for me, working with monster fiction. And honestly, the decision to do Godzilla and Godzilla Raids Again came along during the pandemic when I was bored out of my mind and and looking for something really interesting to do. So I realized that there were these Godzilla novels out there from the 1950s, which had never been translated, and it seemed like such a good opportunity.
So, how did you get into Japanese literature? Like, as your career path, was that always something that's I'm just always fascinated by people who get into like such niche or professions like that.
Oh, good. Yeah, definitely it is a niche kind of profession, no doubt about that. So when I was 15, I went to Japan for the first time, and I was just completely fascinated. I was a high school exchange student. I decided that I was going to learn Japanese and really master the language. And since I love to read, the confluence of Japanese and literature just seemed like a natural development. So yeah, over time, I kept on returning to translation over and over again. First, in my work before becoming a professor, before graduate school, and I just loved it. Translation's a bit like doing a gigantic intellectual puzzle, taking a lot of pieces and putting them together in a way that is satisfying for a reader in the target language. And so I just really, really enjoy the process of kind of digging deep into a text and thinking about all the little teeny tiny component parts and putting them together in a way that helps bring a work of literature alive for a new audience.
So let's go back to the work of Godzilla and Godzilla Strikes Again. I'm
Sure.
always kind of curious about translations, especially for it's an older text. It's from the 50s.
Right.
And
Yes.
was there like any like normally for your profession, do you normally deal with more contemporary texts, and how does that deal with like more something from the 50s is kind of what I'm curious about.
So originally when I wrote my dissertation, back in the day, I finished that in the early, in the early aughts. I was working in literature of the 1930s, 1910s, 20s, and 30s, but mostly the 30s. And then after that, I kind of did a switch, and I started working with a lot of contemporary writers who are alive and writing right now. So this is my first foray into writing, translating the work of the 1950s. But I had translated kind of on either side of that. And there were definitely some interesting things. Like, for instance, there were some references to songs that everyone would have known in the 1950s, but hardly anyone knows today. And so, I had to do a little bit of research, looking up things, looking up place names, trying to figure out kind of the background of specific places that are mentioned in the text and so on. A lot of these things I already knew from my previous reading and previous work, but Godzilla and Godzilla Raids Again are really fun because they were specifically designed to appeal to Tokyoites. When Godzilla is kind of tromping through Tokyo, destroying one building after another, he's not just destroying generic buildings, but he's actually destroying real places that Tokyoites would have known and recognized. So the author definitely put a lot of thought into, okay, now what buildings am I going to choose to have Godzilla stomp upon? So it's kind of fun thinking about, well, what did those particular buildings and places represent to a reader in the 1950s? And so that was one of the things that I went into in my afterword. There's actually a lot of thought that goes into this. It's not just sort of like a monster randomly, tramping through a city, and just destroying everything in sight. There is a little bit of that, but yeah, the author specifically chose particular buildings and so on that his viewers would recognize and relate to. So all that was really interesting, a lot of fun.
Which I always kind of think is like, for translation, especially for I'm a monolingual. I took Latin in college, and like that was kind of it. Mostly because I just didn't have to speak the language. Because it was easier to read and write, but like for a lot of translation, it is like Google Translate, churn in, churn out. But you do miss those cultural contexts when it comes to translation, and that's why I always find kind of fascinating is like, what do you as a translator pick and choose for? As kind of the bridge between this one media into an English speaking audience.
That's a really good question. I do think that that sort of kind of value added thing that a translator can do by sort of explaining the context, illuminating some of the ideas that might have gone into the text and so on. I think that's one of the really nice things that we can do as scholars and translators. And so I always try to, bring that to any text that I work on. I usually that's the reason that I often like, add a translator's afterword, where I talk about some of the things. Like for Godzilla and Godzilla Raids Again, I think I wrote something like 45 pages or so, kind of talking about the cultural context. In The Luminous Fairies and Mothra, even though it's a relatively short novella, my afterword ended up being, almost twice as long as the novella itself, just because there was so much to say about it. A lot of people have written a lot about Godzilla and all the different Godzilla stories, but there I discovered, much to my surprise, that when I started working on the Mothra novella, that there was a lot less writing out there in English and in Japanese about the particular novella as well as the film. So I felt like there was a lot more to say with the Mothra book.
Do you think it was just because it just isn't as popular as Godzilla? Like everybody knows Godzilla, but not in like in terms of like the kaiju extended universe.
Yeah, absolutely. Godzilla is definitely a household name practically anywhere you go on the planet. This is a little bit of an aside here, but some years ago I was backpacking in northern Guatemala, and I happened to find a t-shirt, like kind of in this little town in the middle of nowhere that had a big image of Godzilla stepping on a bunch of firecrackers. And it turns out that the El Gran Cotia is the big Godzilla is the name of a Guatemalan firecracker. And it made me think like made me think like, wow, Godzilla is known even here in rural northern Guatemala. Like, how exciting is that?
That's really cool.
Yeah,
Notre Dame.
doesn't have quite the same name recognition, but definitely is well known too.
I'm kind of curious. Did you have to go through like all the films and just rewatch every single film to get the novellas perspective, like to kind of bounce back and forth between the text and the movies?
I did, yeah. So I first of all, I should preface this by saying that, when I was little, I loved watching those movies because they were so much fun. But as I got older, I didn't really think of them as kind of an object of scholarly study because I thought, well, I mi mistakenly assumed that, everything that had been, needed to be said about these, monsters in this universe had already been said. But that wasn't true at all. One of the things that I realized when I discovered that these novellas were out there and just waiting to be translated, I realized that the novellas are a slightly different manifestation of the story than the movies themselves. So of course I went back and I watched the movies, but I also went into these particular projects realizing that the books might be slightly different than the movies. And that was okay. In fact, that's part of the fun, I think, of the entire venture, sort of looking at the different kind of nuances and the way that the stories have changed between the novel version and the film version.
Can
So
you
they're
elaborate?
different. Yeah.
Can you elaborate more, like what was like your most shocking change between the book and the novellas?
So one of the things that really surprised me, I'll start with Godzilla first and maybe say something about Mothra. I was really astounded when I sat down and I read Godzilla from cover to cover that there was not a single pronoun anywhere in the entire text that would give us even the slightest hint of what Godzilla's gender might be. And so isn't that interesting? I had always sort of I guess just assumed, maybe it was led this way because of subtitles or whatever, but I guess I tended to think about Godzilla as male. I think people in English often refer to Godzilla as a he or him. But actually, when I went back and looked at this early 1950s text, although Godzilla is practically on every page, there's no pronouns whatsoever. That's something that's much easier to pull off in Japanese than it is in English. Because, if something is just already known from context, they don't even need to stick in a pronoun. They just leave it out. And so anyway, it was really interesting for me to discover that that Godzilla wasn't necessarily male as I had assumed him to be, at least in that early incarnation.
Does Mothra have
Yeah.
that sort of gendered context as well, or?
So actually, much to my surprise, I found that Mothra also too was somewhat ambiguous when it came to gender. I think that when people talk about Mothra, they often use the feminine pronouns he, she, her, and people often talk about Godzilla and Mothra as kind of an almost dichotomous pair, like a yin yang pair, with like Godzilla representing the kind of angry, pissed off male, and Mothra sort of representing a sort of protective, benevolent, kinder female figure. A lot of people have pointed to the fact that the word Mothra actually sounds like the English word mother. So at least in the way that the discourse has developed, there is this kind of very gendered aspect to it. But at least in these early novels, that wasn't the case. That was something that actually developed later as these universes kind of went into more and more kind of modern iterations. In Mothra, much to my surprise, there was no mention of gender, no mention, no mention, no mention, no mention, no mention, until suddenly, late in the novel, there's about four places or where they refer to Mothra in the larva stage as he, and then suddenly all pronouns disappear again from there to the end of the novel. And it's a mystery that I haven't been able to explain entirely. But because Mothra is sort of a story about transformation, the kaiju starts off as a gigantic egg, then goes through the kind of pupa phase, then becomes, the moth at the end. I decided that it was okay to kind of keep this sort of ambiguous pronoun it for talking about the egg, and then switch to he where it appears in the story for about, just a couple of pages, and then switch and then I kind of made the sort of radical decision to switch the female pronoun she at the end of the story.
Oh.
And part of that was because, as I said, like Mothra is typically seen in the English speaking world as female. And I also would like to point out that I've got lots and lots of friends in the kaiju loving world who are fans. And it seems like Mothra in particular, because of this transformation aspect, has lots and lots and lots of trans fans. And so I really wanted to honor that and to bring that forward in my translation. So so I made the kind of interesting and quirky decision to use different pronouns at different points in the novel. And then of course, because there's a translator's afterword, I use that as my how do you say this in English? In Japanese, nigemichi, the way of my escape route for sort of explaining my quirky decision to do this. But
I
yeah.
love that. That's beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
Think trans rights for
Yay.
Mothra. But the first thing I always think about with like gendered, like in America, because the English pronouns and like we are introducing like they, them as a gender neutral pronoun that hasn't super caught on in certain more conservative social circles. The first thing I think like Kirby, because when I was growing up, I always heard Kirby as male, but apparently, like original Japanese, it's gender ambiguous because it's just not really, it doesn't have an assigned gender. And apparently, the Japanese language, from what I've read in like some online forum for Nintendo, was like just made a little bit easier to make that more ambiguous. And I didn't realize maybe that's a similar idea for Godzilla.
No, absolutely. Absolutely is. Yeah.
That's it. I kind of want to talk a little bit more about that. Do you think like more contemporary versions of Godzilla have that more male assigned now, as opposed to the original novella, or is that just more of like a Western interpretation? Like, if you go travel to Japan, is like Godzilla just completely gender neutral as well?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. As I was kind of looking into this and sort of struggling with what to do with Godzilla's gender, in the first book, I, looked into this question a little bit, and it does seem that early on, when Toho Studios first created these movies, back in the 1950s, 1960s, I don't really think that they were thinking about Godzilla's gender all that much. That kind of seemed to be a little bit of an afterthought. And in subtitles, I think were when they sent that text out, the film out into the world, that became an issue, right? What gender is Godzilla? But for the Japanese audience, it didn't really seem to be kind of a pressing concern. So, as Godzilla goes out into the world, it's really there that he seems to be increasingly called a he. See, even I'm doing it subconsciously. But in reality, that's not there. Later on, I'm not sure exactly what at what point Toho Studios made this decision, but they decided that officially Godzilla was gender neutral. And so in the more recent Godzilla movies, the ones that are made in Japan, Toho Studios has kind of set, given the instructions that in the subtitles, the gender neutral pronoun it or something like that should be used, or pronouns should just be avoided altogether to kind of sidestep this issue. So in the more recent iterations of the Godzilla universe, especially in the form of the MonsterVerse, which is kind of like the show that's Monarch, which is showing on Apple TV right now. They really go along with that, and they seem to try to sidestep the question of gender a bit.
That's interesting. I love that actually. I think that's a really cool, it's like cool social development, I guess, in terms of like how the universe, which kind of makes it a little bit more difficult to make things more gender neutral, because it seems like the English language really wants to have, or like any romantic language, really in Spanish as well, really wants to put a gender neutral thing for everything, or they'll use like the male pseudonym for it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so that's one of the really interesting differences between the East Asian languages and the Western European Indo-European languages. They definitely have a different approach to gender.
My this is a biff and a bit of an aside, but I'm corresponding. One of our guest hosts, John Terrazas, he does Spanish Book Club, and
Oh.
which is all Spanish language book club every third week,
Uh-huh.
or so, which is really fun. But I get on these email chains, and I'm not a Spanish speaker. I just kind of help facilitate this. But he'll email every email signature for like his book club members. He'll do "Hola amigos," but the way he spells amigos is with the at symbol for like internet, like at Gmail. So
Oh,
both circle and an at to like make it more gender inclusive, and I think that's
Nice.
funny on a text. And I'm like, I've never seen that because I thought I was getting a typo, and I'm like, oh no, that's like a deliberate way to make amigos more gender neutral, was by just
Interesting.
that symbol.
I love it.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's very hip.
It is. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that we're all familiar with the word Latinx right now. And yeah, but like I'd never heard that about amigos. That's cool.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where it's like I don't know how to like audibly say that, but like in text,
Yeah.
like I can read. I was like, oh, that's the gender neutral, and it's just the at symbol.
Yeah,
But
that's really cool because it's kind of like almost like an O surrounding an A. So it's kind of like it's got both of the choices in there. Anyway,
I
sorry for
just thought,
geeking out here.
oh yeah, that's really cool. It's language, but it's like how text relates to that. What I did want to, because it is going to be Earth Day the next day when we play this show live.
Yeah.
But I've always heard like the environmentalism with Godzilla, and
Yes.
I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit more about that, because
Absolutely. So yeah, I think Godzilla definitely from right from the very conception has an environmental edge to the story. The main thing that was on the authors' minds when they wrote Godzilla in 1954 was the fear of radiation. The thing that inspired Godzilla most directly was an incident in early 1954 when there was a group of 23, I think it was, fishermen who were out in the Pacific, catching tuna, and they happened to be very unlucky and be close to Bikini Atoll, where the U.S. Was testing out its new hydrogen weapons, and so they got caught in the blast, and so these poor fishermen were irradiated and were rushed back to Japan, and one of them died from radiation sickness within the year. And so this was this was all front page news in Japan. It was very shocking to the Japanese population, which is already, had terrible memories of, atomic weaponry with, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was terrifying to them to realize that the US and later the Soviet Union were developing these hydrogen bombs, which were literally like 1,000 times greater than the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So their first, I mean, when the writers first sat down to write Godzilla, Godzilla was sort of a metaphor for the kind of radiation that would be released by hydrogen bombs that might come ashore in Japan, no matter what the Japanese population did or said. So radiation was first on their mind, but if we, look closer at the story, we see that the reason that Godzilla woke up in the first place and started, tromping across Japan was because his natural habitat was destroyed by these nuclear blasts. And so environmental destruction is the kind of immediate trigger for Godzilla's rampage. So that gets carried forward in a bunch of the movies that are created over time. And that environmental message becomes even stronger and stronger. There was a movie that was released, I think it was 1971, which was called Godzilla versus Hedorah, and that one, the monster Hedorah, is specifically a smog monster, which is created out of the pollution that is released into the atmosphere, into the oceans by mankind. So that's the place where, like, the Godzilla universe takes this very, very explicit environmental direction. That only kind of continues onward in the current iterations of the Godzilla universe. So
Do you
really
think it's
interesting stuff.
Do you think it's almost like impossible to remove Godzilla from like the environmental context because like it is such a strong metaphor? Because like the first thing I think of is Godzilla is like not only just the monster, like cool monster smashing things, love that, but like my introduction was also like environmentalism as well. And does that also to like other monsters within the like the universe as well, or is it
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, definitely. Especially as you if you begin to watch like some of the newer movies, the ones that have been released in the Heisei era in Japan, and the Reiwa era. Those are words that are probably familiar to some of the fans out there. But yeah, some of the recent films, they definitely kind of lean heavily into this environmental message that somehow it's never terribly well explained in films, but the monsters themselves sort of represent the grand forces of nature, which kind of take revenge on humanity when humanity is too destructive. Somehow the monsters seem to keep nature in balance. That's kind of the main idea. So yeah, so there's definitely an environmental edge, especially in the most recent iterations of this whole world.
Yeah, because the first thing of like I think of with Godzilla is like obviously radiation and a nuclear disaster, but as climate change starts to kind of rear its ugly head, is that also been an aspect within the more contemporary films as well?
Yeah, no, at 100%. So there definitely is some of that. I don't get the impression that Toho Studios is leaning really hard into the kind of climate change angle in the writing of the plot, but I do feel like it's there in the background. One more thing that I might mention here that I found really interesting is that as I began to kind of like work on this whole thing and go back through the entire Godzilla universe and look at all the various monsters, I realized that one of the earliest other big monster kaiju films out of Japan, also from Toho Studios, coming very soon on the heels of Godzilla, is the monster Rodan. Who's kind of the star of a film that was released in the late 1950s. And this when I went back and I found the novella that this movie was based on, I was really kind of surprised to realize that this monster emerges from a coal mine and the coal mines in southern Japan. And as he kind of flies across Japan, he creates lots of destruction through the flapping of his wing, gigantic wings, which create this hot air that blows across everything. So, I mean, it was really surprising for me to realize that in this text here from the 1950s, already there is a connection being made between fossil fuels and climate change.
Oh, I
Like,
find that. Oh, that's so cool.
I know, I was kind of blown away by that. And especially because it's coming so early. I mean, I think it was really only in the 1950s that scientists began to pick up on the idea that maybe humans were affecting the atmosphere. So it's a relatively early acknowledgement of that. And so I've asked University of Minnesota Press if they'll let me do that book next.
right.
We have to clear the rights yet. So
Ooh.
I can't promise, that everything's going to work out, but it seems like the University of Minnesota Press is really excited by this idea, and you can tell already that I'm geeking out about
Right, I do have one last question for you. What was your
Yeah.
favorite novella from the Godzilla or Mothra? Like anyone's like, oh, I would love to read this again and again, or like this one was just really struck out to me as like one of my favorite pieces.
I really, really enjoyed working the Luminous Fairies in Mothra. And part of that was because it's very short. It's only about 45 pages or so. But it's written by three people, which means that it's kind of a really weird, quirky text. They wrote it by relay. So like one person wrote the beginning, one person wrote the middle, the other person wrote the end. And so there's a kind of like quirky unevenness about the text, which sort of makes it more fun for me. Like each of the three authors had their own specific kind of interests, and they kind of worked those into their portion of the text. And so I really enjoyed that. It left a lot of room for me as a reader, as a translator, to kind of think about like, what is each writer doing? I got to think about that three times more than I got to think about like the single-authored Godzilla and Godzilla Raids Again.
So cool. All right. Thank you so much. That's all the time we have today. Thank you, Jeffrey Engels, for coming on the air tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for Jeffrey Engels' books, Godzilla and Godzilla Strikes Again, and The Luminous Fairies and Mothra are going to be available through the University of Minnesota Press. And thank you so much for coming on the air.
Absolutely. No, this has been a delight. Thanks so much for spending some time with me.
Yeah. All right.